All right, hello and welcome back to the Buck Starts Here, Buck Wild Edition. Did I not tell you, Eric, that that's what we call this for the season intermission?
I'm scared. I am scared.
All right, I am Kyle, and not only is my esteemed co-host Eric Mason here, but we also managed to bring back Ray Faba, our in-house art expert, for another look at the portraits and masterpieces from the colonial era. I have peeked at the notes, so I know we're going to be talking about the differences between photographs and painting, and maybe we even get to play a little historical game of Where's Waldo. Now that I've properly teased the upcoming content, I'll cede the mic to whoever wants to kick us off.
I will say that this is unique because I'm, as Kyle's usually the one in the dark as we venture down a scary road, I am now the one in the dark venturing down the scary road.
Well, if you're in the dark, it's your own excited. Fault because she sent you her notes.
I didn't see that.
Yeah.
I was looking for notes too. You guys know how neurotic I am. Oh, this is going to be scary. Do I not bring up the notes? Do we just roll with this?
It's up to you. I mean, if you want to.
No, I'm going to let Ray make the decision. Should I look at the notes or should you scare me?
I don't want you to have a neurotic meltdown. Okay. Nobody wants
you people
to
are too
that.
Nice to me. Where
yeah,
is
friend,
this?
It's not cool. It's funny.
Where is?
But it's mean.
Oh, it's even better. Is he?
Oh,
didn't
look
see...
at that! What? Oh, I just saw the response. With this is sweet. I didn't see the connection
the
underneath it.
After the sweet.
Oh, this could have been.
Dude, sweet.
You probably also missed the Iwo Jima pictures in there.
Wait, what?
That's the other thing we got to talk about when we're done here, is how we're going to bring Ray back for World War II.
Whoa, this is... Okay, dude, sorry, I didn't mean to get distracted there. That's awesome.
One of those pictures looks like an original of the flag raising.
Originals of both of the flag raisings that Roosevelt took. Yeah, the gung-ho, where everybody's holding their gun over their head, and then also the one where the flag's on its way up.
The three people,
there's,
the one...
I think there's five, but
oh, that's amazing.
There's
a whole crazy story
about how that came to happen.
So, real quick, just to tease that, let me ask you a question. If we had modern media, do you think we would have been able to fight World War II?
No.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I agree with that. Killed, I think that's a hot take.
I was going to say, let me ask you. Yeah.
The Dresden firebombing?
Do you think that modern media helped our struggle in Vietnam?
No. We're gonna have not to tease that. We're gonna have fun during that episode.
One redheaded brain cell right there for just a second. We were like Vietnam, very bad.
Yeah, like we dropped like napalm on Japan, which is like nothing but paper houses. I'm pretty sure if anybody had video footage of that, we'd probably be in some sort of Geneva convention. Mm-hmm.
Because my thought on it was like we were more tolerant, like not tolerant, like the U.S. populace was more tolerant because of the attack on Pearl Harbor than say like Vietnam, where it's like I don't think the average American felt threatened by that.
The problem is the average American didn't know you're out there like having to make like really hard choices, like a 7-year-old coming up holding a stuffed bear. You don't know if that's a grenade or not.
No, I do agree with that. But that episode's going to be wild.
Like how horrible war is? Yeah, that's
and
what ruined
I think modern media, I think...
ruined it?
I think Dresden is a great example of that, too. We would not have gotten away with...
Yeah, the firebombing and...
some of that. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know if that would have been a good thing or a bad thing. One wonders if we had modern media, would the Second World War have even kicked off?
Well, we wouldn't have had FDR as president because I can't imagine getting elected this day and age.
That too. I mean, yeah, that's a let's circle back to that when we get there, and I'll think about the role of propaganda. They did pretty good with what they had, and it's a big question of would an enhancement in media technology have made people more gung ho about the war or less? Thinking just about how propaganda worked during the Second World War. We might have a chance to dip into Soviet heroic realism today when we talk about portraits, but you know, I'm kind of thinking along those lines. That was big propaganda.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. Okay, well, since we kind of already just jumped into the topic then. So one of the things that we were kind of talking about when we wrapped up with Mr. John Quincy Adams was him being the first president to be photographed. It wasn't a presidential portrait, but he was the first president to be photographed, correct? Yes. Okay. So That brought up a really interesting discussion, I think, that we had kind of offline that we're saving for here. But the differences between, or like, is a portrait more accurate than a photograph or vice versa? Like, there's some real question, I think, there, because you can stage a photograph just the same way you can stage
and
a painting.
And you prepare to sit for a photographer the way we would have prepared to sit for a portrait painter. So they do have a lot in common. Mm-hmm. An interesting thing happens with photography. In the beginning, people think it's the most realist reel of reels of all time to be the realest thing. Like, this is really real, what that person really, really real looked like for real. And so it's like wildly, it's like a carnival. You know, we have photographers hauling around. They go through a couple, technology moves quickly. There's that rule. I can't remember the name of it, but once the technology starts, it, yes.
Moore's
it,
law?
It, yeah, Moore's law.
Additively and geometrically expands very quickly. So photography, it's the same thing. So mm-hmm. So photographs start, and it's really a giant pain in the ass to take a photograph. I mean, it's like a 15-minute exposure. The chemicals are dangerous. There's a whole thing. And then we get calotypes and daguerreotypes, and those are what you guys think of. Those are like the tin plates. It's a copper or tin plate. It's coated in silver. The development time is about 2 or 3 minutes. So that is immensely sittable. Like, you can sit there and hold your breath and stare, breathing very carefully, and now everybody wants to have their photograph taken. So
Ray, would this be the same materials that I was probably using in like my technology class when I went to high school 20 years ago? Because I remember doing like pinhole cameras and like developing photographs and things like that.
You did pinhole camera on coated photograph paper. So there is some silver content in there. Yes. We still use silver nitrate in film. The chemicals are similar, but these were metal plates. Like, it wasn't a paper photograph. It's not a paper photograph until, oh boy, I think the tintype. And that's the first time we see the camera takes a negative image, and then you transfer it to paper for mm-hmm. the positive image. So the very first cameras were positive images, just like your pinhole. That was not new technology. We had something called a camera obscura, and a lot of the Northern Renaissance artists used this, and it was a little piece of glass in a box that kind of projected, you know, your shape. So you could project your sketch big onto your canvas and be able to work from that. I actually have one. I should have gotten it out of the bin. Sorry. If we take a break, I'll pull it. Oh, hang on. I have a camera Lucida. It's very similar, but you mount it to a table.
This is awesome.
This is a clamp. It mounts to your table. And then in here is a tiny, where's my camera? It's a tiny little prism. And you angle it, you look across it, and whatever you're looking at is projected onto your paper. And then, you know, of course, we have Newton and optics, and we start getting all of these kinds of capacities, and artists and creatives and grifters. We love that. So we love those grifters. Yeah,
we're a big fan of the grifters on this show. Like, it's good for the narrative.
So you start to get like carnival barkers coming town to town, and you're getting your photograph taken, and everyone thinks it's great. Everyone thinks it's super real. No one wants their newspapers printed with engravings that are from drawings anymore. They now want people to make an engraving based on the photograph. They want that assurance. This is really what it really looks like. The realest of reels. And they start to pick apart then, you know, things about portrait painting and landscape painting and historical painting.
Hold up a sec, Ray. I'm sorry, you're kind of lagging here a little bit.
Eric, are you taking notes of my notes?
People have it.
I'm writing down questions.
You absolute freak. What am I going to do with you?
No, I have so many questions. This is so interesting. This is like the most interesting topic to me, because it's like, when did reality become where you could record it? And I really think that's what we're talking about here. Yes. And I love the idea of like, Oh, no. People have always been trying to manipulate reality. Like, I think this is a philosophical discussion. Like, I think it's philosophy disguised as photography.
This is an art history question. Yeah. I mean, and I'll go all the way back. And when I blew your mind last time, we talked about my master's concentration being in the Neolithic. And you were just like, you're going to drop that bomb tell anybody about it? Well, we were trying, that was the coolest thing in the world. The Magdalenians were trying to do that when they painted on the cave walls, bro. Like, we've always been trying to describe reality. Right.
Yeah, so I have this weird thing where, like, if you look at human intelligence, you could take a human who was born 150,000 years ago, bring them to today, and, like, they relatively could learn everything.
Yep.
So I'm like, how much history is just trapped there? And I feel like the earliest glimpses of humanity we get that are physically still here in their form that they were created, it's like cave paintings. It's like Neolithic art. And I'm really obsessed with that. Like, I just think it's cool.
My concentration was the way it was. I've always been interested in those people. And I share some cultural and genetic lineage with the Magdalenian people. So they're like my first ancestors, the first artists. I'm an artist. Like, I see a line of my people back to the beginning in that, you know. Okay, so what was I saying? Right. I was saying we had talked about crossing the Delaware, and that painting had been done 75 years after the actual event, and by a guy in Germany who had no idea.
What?
Yeah, it was a German fella. Lloyds.
Yeah, I fell down this. I got this.
Eric, awesome. Is it Lloyds? Okay,
I think it's Lloyds. Yeah.
Yeah, he's in Germany. It's 75 years after the event happens, and he's imagining in his mind, in this sort of neoclassical Hellenistic.
Okay.
He's got a plan, and he knows some of the people were there. And he knows some stories, and he really, really admires the American Revolution. He thinks that this can spark a liberal reformation in Germany. So he paints this thing, and it's a nice painting, been just riddled with inaccuracies. I mean,
did he do any research?
It's hard to say how much research he could have done. This is not a time where research, like, he hopped on Google.
I always thought the funniest part of it is, like, some of the people slain in that battle were Hessians, who are German mercenaries.
Almost all of the people were either Hessians or the children of Hessians.
There was a lot of German blood involved in that transaction.
Yeah. Christmas Eve. Well,
you know what they say over in England. It's not a proper war until you frighten Jerry.
Is that what they say over there, Kyle?
Yes, it is. I just listened to Jeremy Clarkson say it.
Don't Jeremy Clarkson, the arbiter of reality.
Yeah, he's the keeper of all things.
He's nuts.
Okay. I was trying to find a picture of this so I can pull it up.
Okay, so the first thing people pick on is the boat. The boat is wrong. And not even close to the type of boat that would have been used. And then, you know, Washington is standing. People complain about that. They're like, nobody's going to stand on this. But there's there's some really other odd things. It's the wrong flag. It's the Betsy Ross flag, right? This person... flag. This person in the red shirt here that's rowing is apparently a woman. Now, I have heard stories that there were prostitutes that helped out during the revolution. Not just.
Do you think they rowed the boat, though?
I don't think so. No, I don't think the women rowed the boat. That's really. I realize that that's not very progressive of me, but no, I don't think the women rowed the boat. And there's a black fella in there. Because he must have heard that there had been a number of free black people that fought in the revolution. And Prince, I can't remember his name, that? Prince something, it's in the notes. He's also rowing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So.
I believe that.
I do believe that. Yeah, absolutely. Oh, and in the background, he's got there are other characters that people have noticed that they think are out of place. All the way in the way back, he's got some, those are the Hessians, I suppose, back there on the shore. And then...
Wait, what?
All the way in the back, behind... Okay, so there's the guy who's, like, steering at the front with the pole. If you look to the left of that, you can see the men and the horses on the shore. But they weren't on the shore.
Left of that, over here, you mean?
But they weren't on the shore waiting. They were sleeping in their beds in a snowstorm on Christmas Eve, and they were ambushed and murdered.
Wait, say that again, I'm sorry.
They weren't waiting on the shore. They were sleeping through a snowstorm.
Oh, right, yes. That's the whole
and
point.
And they were ambushed and murdered.
Yeah, this looks very sunny, like in their tents, actually.
That's supposed to be the North Star up there in the sky. So there's a lot of symbolism here. This draws from this neoclassical ideal of the general, the warrior king leading his men into war. It's in the shape of an active triangle, so there's all this visual activity in the way that it's designed, and he's taken enormous liberties with all kinds of things.
Wait, real quick. I have kind of a dumb question, but like, how widely circulated did this become once it happened? Like, it's not like you could reproduce this online, but where people are like, dude, this is not what this looks like at all. And he was like, nah, I'm good. Like what point was it easy? Like, I always thought that was cool about photography, which that it so quickly became like available. But what I realized, I've been told by other smart people like you, Ray, who are like, no, there was still the engravement process. It wasn't as widespread as we think of photography today. Like, that revolution didn't become until paper photography became more common. And like, it's obviously hard to scale here. But like, was anybody able to tell this guy that he was just horribly wrong? Like, this is not how anything looks.
No.
Like.
Was it like John Adams at the Declaration of Independence signing when he's like, this isn't how it happened at all.
No, I don't know when this painting came to the United States. I believe it's in the Met Gallery now. I think it's at the Metropolitan, but really? I don't know when it came here. And it's very likely that the audience mm-hmm. for which he was painting, and he did this as a piece of propaganda, would never. Yeah.
Really?
They had heard about America. This big experiment in liberal democracy. So he really was trying to push this idea that art could inspire these people. And this is big in neoclassicism, this idea that the visual inspires rational, romantic, nationalist heroism. Like, these are all ideals. And he wanted Germany to adopt these things.
Oh, so
what
this
was
is
going
so cool
on in Germany at that
That's
point in time.
That's an Eric question.
not reunification. 1850s. This is the late 1840s. If it was,
this is about the time when Germany's like actually becoming its own country again, right? After
the rise of you're seeing the fall of the papal states mixed with the rise of, I don't want to say ethno-nationalism, but. Not ethno-nationalism. I know that means something different today. I'm saying like the idea of like, we're not being, there's not all these
kings
and stuff.
When Italy ceased to be city-states and became Italy, we referred to this as Italianita, that the whole of Italy. So maybe the Germans have a word. It's like 8 or 9 words all crammed together for that. That sense of national identity, right? So Leutz would have been painting at this time where Germany was looking for a national identity. And maybe his line must have been, hey, look, this young country across the way over there, they've got some identity. Look at how cool they are. They have a boat and icebergs in their river. And guys and horses on the shoreline, right?
horses
on
the
boat.
Boats. Horses on a boat.
Women are rowing. Right. So, but he was. So this, that would have been an appropriate time for him to make this kind of statement. This type of colonial American art is not super my specialty, not in my wheelhouse. So I don't know contextually much about the guy. As far as research he might have been able to do, Gossip around town. I mean, that's really all you had.
Well, I guess what
you don't have newspapers.
What sort of materials? Yeah, what sort of books or literature was written? This is what, 50 years, 75 years after the fact? Like, what's actually been published at this point that he could even get his hands on?
Benjamin Franklin wrote, which was all kinds of bizarre. I don't know if you guys have read his.
De Tocqueville was pretty popular. Oh, yeah. I have. Ray, I go on my rant that the most inappropriate book in your children's library is Benjamin Franklin's autobiography.
Was finished by his son writing at him, and you can't tell the difference. It's a terrible book. So, in any case,
it is. Yeah, absolutely.
So obviously we would have had de Tocqueville coming here, and he would have been publishing pamphlets first, pamphleteering before we think of Democracy in America as being two volumes of a book, but pamphleteering was pretty popular. You guys remember printing presses were like the size of your kitchen table, and that was how much print you could put down, and then that was done. The way we open and fold newspapers now, that doesn't happen until blanket printing. So there's a whole technology change for that we haven't reached yet in this, you know, situation. So, I mean, what he would have read would have been, you know, some word of mouth. He probably would have known people who had family members that traveled or traded, you know, back and forth. Artists were kind of in the merchant class. Suda had a lot of, like, commercial contacts, buying and selling. Hearsay, though, mostly, I would think, and gossip. And honestly, it's hard to say when it got here, if it had gotten here very early in American history, how many Americans would have noticed the inaccuracies? Because they wouldn't have really known this story either the way that we do. And most of them wouldn't have the ability to travel there, to look at the landscape, to know that, you know, that you don't see the North Star on that side of the sky that time of year. Like,
or, you know, during daylight,
and the rain
horses are not usually in boats.
Women are not rowing horses across iceberg laden rivers.
Women are not rowing.
You know,
where's Monroe? Is he in there?
Do you want to take a guess?
I'm gonna guess not. I don't see anybody who's been shot laying down.
I don't think Monroe was famous enough.
Well, Monroe was
at the time of the painting.
He's been a president
Monroe
at that point.
He was there at Delaware, but he was staying at someone else's house, right? He was not part of the river party, but he's actually...
He wasn't? I thought he was shot.
No, he was shot after the crossing.
Yeah, he was shot during the battle? Because, like, came across and they basically killed everybody in their tents. And then everybody started, then everything kind of went crazy.
So he's actually the fellow holding the flag.
Oh,
how do you guys like that?
Oh God, that's amazing. That is. Let me get the picture.
He was wounded. I think in his neck. It was like an arterial wound. It was
his shoulder.
I think it was like the neck.
Yeah, he shot right here.
It was bad. Yeah. Whatever it was.
Dr. Riker. Yeah, Dr. Riker basically reached and pinched the artery until it clotted.
Right here.
Like. It's kind of gross.
It's right behind the flag. That's where he's covering it with he's using the flag to compress his wound.
So by the time this was painted, he was more famous.
His colors don't run.
Betsy Ross still hasn't sewn this flag.
Yeah.
That's such a fire pick, right, by the way, to point that out on the flag.
So, yeah, it's an interesting... He pops up here and there. People have looked for him. There's a rumor that he was in, I can't remember who the artist was, one of Napoleon's coronation pictures. People have been trying to figure out who he is in the audience for years. So they wanted to say there were Americans there. I'm not sure if he would have been there, but people just keep scanning back through here trying to determine, did someone slide him in? He was a popular addition to paintings in this time. But really I don't personally know that he's in there.
Strong Charlemagne vibes to this. There's strong Charlemagne coronation vibes.
This is what the Europeans do. They're rehashing all of their symbolism every time they need to legitimize somebody.
Pomp and circumstance.
Yeah. But it's crazy because there's like a 1,000-year difference between these two events.
Yeah, but there's.
Yeah, Charlemagne was 800.
What do you do when you want the people to accept your legitimacy as a ruler? Well, my great 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 grandfather was your ruler, and you liked him.
Well, you do that, or you can murder all the people who dissent.
Yeah, like I feel like that's so like weird as an American to think like to us we'd be like, all right, so your father did something, whatever. Yeah. Like,
big you know,
so
yeah, like what's that, Article 3, Section 5, or whatever of the Constitution? Like, no bit, like there are no such things as inherited titles. But like for the rest of the world, that's right, how everything works. Yeah. Like literally. Yeah. Like,
so the other day, Kyle asked me why don't American paintings have all of the little funny tropes and icons and gags in them that we always see in European art, and it's because all of those came.
That's not what I asked you.
All of those things came from this iconography, and it carries and carries and carries and carries, and we just don't have that here.
Right. This brings me to like one of my questions that I wanted to talk to you on. So like, I think some of the interpretations, and I say this as somebody who's certainly more the econ and history focus of this discussion, though I will say I hate that art history and history sometimes get talked about as separate fields, because I don't think they are. I think they're the same field with different lenses. American mm-hmm. history before photography was relatively short compared to the rest of the world. I guess I don't want to like base my question on an assumption that you guys don't agree with, but I think it's relatively a short period of time between 1776 and kind of the first photograph.
Very short, like, but 30 years.
Would you say that we shouldn't think of American, sorry, let me rephrase this. Would you say that we shouldn't think of the art history of the United States stopping at the invention of the photography? That, well, we could talk about the crossing of the Delaware, we could talk about the addition of photography, that these two things remained intertwined, maybe even to today. That both paint representations of paintings and the advent of photography were both used in the narrative of the United States until, again, I don't know if you agree until today. I don't know if you think there was a point where they began to diverge again, but I'm curious what your thoughts are.
I absolutely think that you're correct when you say that. America sort of does with art, like photography and, you know, sort of storytelling, the same way that the Romans did with the Hellenistic Greek stuff. They reproduced it. They made it better. They mass produced it. So in Rome, you'd have a statue. This is why Roman statues, there's tons of heads, but not a lot of bodies. They would mass produce bodies, and you'd have like a warrior and like a philosopher. And then your local artisan would make the head of your local guy and pop it on there.
Whoa.
Yeah, so
I love the economy.
That they were not white either. They were also like
painted.
Multicolored.
They were painted. Yeah. They were outstanding. Right.
Oh, they were. They would be unsettling to look at.
Yes.
You can look up. There's one of a Phoenician court member that has been just look up Phoenician statue recolored if you want to kind of see it's. And everyone finds it unsettling. It was a recent, maybe the last 10 years or so, some people did some computer recolorizations to show, and they are unsettling. But basically what happens is Rome takes all of these ideas from the Hellenistic Greek, and they modify it and use it for their own storytelling. And in that way, it embeds itself within their culture. And we don't invent photography. But we use the living hell out of photography. We start to make some of the very first interpretive photography where we're doing, I guess you guys could call it like early Photoshop. There's a big scandal because there's a photograph of Abraham Lincoln and they used his head, but someone else's body when they did the print. So Americans have done all kinds of wild stuff with photography. So instead of just taking it and saying this is a photojournalist historical documentation item, we did integrate it into our art language and our cultural language. And I think because we didn't have the rigid structures of European academia, we were able to get away with that. And we can talk about the Hudson River School, which is the school of painting that emerges just around this colonial period and just after. And Americans get really big on landscape paintings because we're conquering the land. And so we have this perception, American artists have this, they paint the landscape as though the landscape is an enemy, but it's an honorable enemy, right? Like a challenge to be overcome and respected.
Sounds like,
and so we have like her.
Sounds like
yeah,
manifest
it's
destiny
totally
propaganda.
Manifest destiny propaganda, and it's baked into who we are. And so,
I mean, it worked. It worked. Yeah. Like, just the record, it definitely worked.
I mean,
it definitely worked.
Kyle and I are both from Northern Michigan. It definitely worked. I mean, my family hit 45 North in like 1910. I mean, they were itching to get up there.
I just wanted to know who stopped at the UP and was like, "Yeah, this looks great."
Polish people, Kyle. It's the Poles.
Oh my gosh.
And the Poles and the Finns, the weirdos.
You kind of talked about some of the different ways that like photography might have been like kind of found some uses. One of the things that we didn't really talk about though is like cartography. I'm curious if photography became an easier way of like sketching out maps or coastlines or
I'm
like,
sure that
was it...
gave huge advancements. And I have almost no cartography or cartographic history experience, but my assumption would be absolutely. You could go up to a cliffside and photograph the shoreline and take those plates back and draw yourself a real nice map. You're obviously going to have some measurement error, but it couldn't have been any worse than what they were doing before, which was basically they get a guy like me in a boat and I just doodle as we go along and we try
as
to
draw,
pretend
that's
a map. So, I mean, that's...
When I was studying geography, I once had a professor say, the art of cartography when it comes to photography is how high can you throw a camera
how high
and
can
still
you throw
snap
camera?
It.
Exactly.
That's essentially satellite. It's like you just like higher and higher and higher.
All the way up.
Yeah. It's really just who can throw the camera the highest is going to win.
Who can get it in a hot air, I mean, who can get it in a hot air balloon? Who can get it on an airplane? I mean, let's talk about the spy planes in World War II. You know, that was huge.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's still crazy how we still use ISR, we still use spy planes because they're able to be updated faster than satellites. That well, obviously, you know, geocentric, geolocked satellites, but I still it's cool. Like the U2 is still used
Which
today.
Is
like that's wild
awesome.
To me.
Yeah.
So yeah, I would think there were a lot of advancements from that. I think photography, it was relatively inexpensive and easy to access, and I cannot think of a single field of engineering or of art that wouldn't have found a use for it. People would have been all over this.
It also would be great, or what I think would be a great use for it. When you're taking a photograph of yourself, you don't have to pay the artist to put in all of the fancy things. You can just collect all of the you own and put it behind you for your one shot.
Your house is empty, but it looks awesome.
Yes, just like
a gold tag.
Okay, so we said we were gonna have a shelf off. Did you bring a shelf off object, Kyle?
Oh, mine's boring.
Because I have
shelf off object.
I have a Jedi holocron.
I have trench art
nice.
From World War I.
My Jedi holocron that my brother made me.
Ooh.
Duck banana.
Is that a duck banana?
Wow.
A duck banana?
That's amazing.
I got one of my best friends sent this to me.
Duck banana. Oh, you know what? I have it's not trench, but I have a Soviet era kukri. It's actually
it's
pretty cool. So, I don't know. It's a kukri?
What is it? Oh, it's like a kukri.
Yeah, I don't know. Do I say it wrong?
Yeah. Dude, I love that duck.
I don't know. It's always on there. I gotta ask her if this is dadism. I think
dadism.
Yeah, like the idea that I can create art because I'm an artist, and that's why it's art. Right. So is this, like, one of my least favorite, and I'm going to pronounce it probably incorrectly, but is, like, Dadaism? Dada. Like, the art is art because I'm an artist?
Dada, yeah.
Ray, one of the things you do impressively is you view art in the context of society. And I think that's something that's really cool, because I think that's what economics does. I think economics, you know, is a study of society. So, you know, when we talk about, you know, as we look back through history, I think we're both doing the same thing. I think we're both studying society, right? I think they're just done through two different lenses. And, you know, as we talk about American history, you know, a lot of the conversations that Kyle and I have is on humanization, right? Like, we talk about a lot of the founding fathers had fathers who died young and how it affected them so much. And, you know, that, as we look at all the different strains that come together to form a historical narrative, right? I think art will always occupy kind of, I don't want to say the most important strain, but the most important ability to interpret what the people at the time thought they were going through. And I think we all have that nostalgic lens. And I think art, whether it's photography or the painting medium, I think it's really good at doing that. I think it's really good at encapsulating that time period. And so kind of on like a closing note, something I want to throw out to you here is that for our listeners, and for me, I'm not going to lie, I'm not going to couch that as like, oh, I'm doing this for the listeners. I'm also curious about it. What are some of the tools that we should look, when we're reviewing art from this time period, whether it's photography, whether it's painting, is there any little cracks that we can look at and see, see how the people at the time were viewing the art? Is there a way that we can kind of put ourselves in the shoes of the people who may have first saw the crossing of the Delaware, right? That painting is like, I just feel like it's a time capsule. It's a time machine, I should say. Is there a way, well, what's your suggestion for us to
appreciate? There's a way to do that. If you want to see like the crack in the universe and kind of like peek in what's going on in another time or another place, that's just the study of art history. You know, art history doesn't exist. It's not just the study of mm-hmm. how do we learn how to draw? How do we learn how to make paint, the chemistry, the geometry, the optics? It's also the context of where something came from. So, if you want to know why a painter paints, the way they did, look at the paintings that they just like, look at your founding fathers' fathers, look at the paintings that they would have seen. How did that influence them? Think about how, you know, the food and the music and the governance, the economic structure, how would those things have changed people? I had a wonderful mentor in college named Charles Goslin, and we called him Goose. So it's funny that we had a goose today. And he would tell me, don't ever try to hide who you are. In your art, your hand will always betray you. And so there is a piece of every person who sits down to arrange a dead body on a battlefield and take a photograph of it, or steal a presidential portrait and sell copies out of the boot of his car. All of the craft that is produced from those efforts does reflect on the person and the culture and the moment that they came from. So, you know, when you look at crossing the Delaware, there's a few contexts there that you could say, we look at this now and we're like, romanticized historical painting. We see those all the time. We're inundated with images and art and the knowledge that is accumulated. But the people who saw that first in Germany, you know, what would they have thought? Well, you know, how would that have inspired them? What would they have known about it? And so the best way to know about art is to ask questions about it and be curious. You don't have to read the 15,000-page Jensen's art history book from cover to cover. It is by its design focused on European art and heavy on the Renaissance forward. But you know, there are all kinds of people writing art history books all the time. Everywhere there are art history blogs. You know, if you wanted to know about sort of neoclassical realism and think about a modern person, Howard Sabin is an American sculptor. He just completed the installation of the World War I monument in Washington, D.C. And His work is astonishingly beautiful, and he talks very openly about his interest in the neoclassical and why he thinks that realism is still something that's important and still holds to us, and why it has purpose in communication and especially in public art. It's really awesome. So we have this huge resource, the internets, right? And the library, support your local library. Go check out an art history book. Because that, essentially what you're asking me is, how do I study art history? And it's just ask questions, you know? Don't ask AI though, because it's just going to return you a banana, a goose.
I just had a thought, Ray, after listening to you and Eric, your question. Like, the idea that Gilbert Stuart would rip off a president, basically, when he was, you know, commissioned to paint that portrait. Yeah, that tells you that they didn't look at him like royalty, right? He was just kind of another dude almost at that point, right? Do you do that to a king? If that was King George who asked you to paint him and his wife, do you stiff King George?
Well,
right?
It really does come to the whole Mr.
There's right? a huge difference right? there.
Mm-hmm. Maybe if Mr. John Adams had gotten his way, there wouldn't have been.
John Adams got done dirty on his portrait. Right. You're
not wrong about that. That,
right?
Like, yeah, he did.
The whole frontage.
How many awful things did he tell that poor portraiter?
Like,
Mr. Rotundo
his highness
President.
Rotundity is what they used to call him. And for all accounts, he was not like that pudgy of a dude. But that artist did not do me.
The first thing that comes to mind when you stand is, hey, well, big fella.
I hate to do this, but we're going to have to.
Yeah, no, right. Oh my God, can we end on that guy?
Yes.
Wait, end on that?
I agree. It's a good spot because we have to do this. Otherwise, if I don't, we're going to be here another week. So please join me in thanking Ray for joining us. You can do that by dropping a comment with your favorite Monroe painting bomb. Is that a term? Yeah. Yeah. If he's out there painting. Yeah. He's the first photo bomber. Yeah. Drop a comment with your favorite Monroe painting bomb. And don't forget to visit the website at buckstartsherepodcast.com. See you all next week. Eric, do you know where the buck stops?
It stops here.
Produced by China Shop Productions.